If there's a rock star in art history, it's got to be Michelangelo. He's been packing them in for 500 years. Think of being a leader in a cultural explosion where the epicenter was Florence, bringing Western civilization out of the Middle Ages and into the modern world. And think of the struggles and the challenges and the complexity of that age when we've got Christian medieval thinking and modern humanism coming together, where we've got the Medicis and their elite friends up in the palaces and hungry peasants out in the streets rumbling. And in the middle of it all, Michelangelo was there, chipping away on that marble. Today we're going to talk about Michelangelo's Florence for sightseers, and I'm joined by two scholars on the topic. Professor William Wallace has written 6 books on Michelangelo. His latest book is Michelangelo, the Artist, the Man, and His Times. And Professor Wallace comes to us from Washington University in St. Louis, where he's a professor of art history. Professor Wallace, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm joined by Gene Openshaw, who's worked with me for years as a guide, and Gene is the co-author of our guidebook, Europe 101 History and Art for Travelers. Gene, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Now, when we think about traveling to Florence and appreciating the age of Michelangelo, it's a challenge for us to kind of put ourselves back 500 years. But this was a heady time when we're coming out of the Dark Ages, and we've got this fancy, famous Renaissance. But Professor Wallace, did the guys in the street know what was going on, or was this just up in the Medici's palace?
No, I think they actually really did know. They were living in a modern world. We trace our beginning of banking and international trade to this time, and this was a city that was flourishing and full of wealthy people, and they absolutely were confident that they were reinventing the modern world.
Now, in your new book, Michelangelo, the Artist, the Man, and His Times, you talk about Michelangelo had noble roots. Did you mean genetically or because he was an insider with the Medici elites?
No, because of the antiquity of his family. As is still true today, the antiquity of your family is the measure of your social prestige. And so Michelangelo was extraordinarily proud that his family was a family that he could trace his roots back 600 years.
Gene, as you travel in Florence, do you pick up on that at his family home? Or?
You know, Bill talks about how it's noble and long lineage, but there's little doubt that his family had fallen on somewhat harder times.
Oh, that's true.
So yeah. In a sense, his aristocratic roots really come from the two families that he grew up in, the Buonarrotis with their long lineage, but somewhat a blue-collar element, and the Medici family, where he spent his teenage years living right in the Medici Palace. Put those two together, and he definitely saw himself as an aristocrat. And if I can add one more thing, in your lead-in, you'd mentioned how Florence was the epicenter of this big Renaissance cultural phenomenon that was blossoming all over Europe. Well, the very epicenter of that in Florence was the Medici Palace. That was Michelangelo's crib when he was growing up in his teenage years.
Now, was Michelangelo, did he see himself as a champion of the common man, or was he a hired hand of the aristocracy?
I think he was very much a hired hand, but of the very best and most important people in society. He ended up working for 9 different popes, and these are the most powerful and the richest people in the world.
But they were just hiring his grade school buddy, weren't they?
Well, in
Didn't he have a playmate?
Two of the Medici, in fact, that he grows up with become pope, yes, the first Florentine pope ever then hires Michelangelo. Well, so this is a very lucky coincidence.
Isn't this an indication of what a small world it was for the educated people or the elites when two of your buddies, when you're just a kid— You're just playing stickball. They become popes.
Yeah, well, think of the world that he grew up in. Michelangelo, he knew Leonardo da Vinci personally. They competed in a painting contest. He was sort of the adopted son of Lorenzo the Magnificent, the most famous man in Europe. Lorenzo's own son grows up to be pope. Well, that was the guy that Michelangelo sat next to in class growing up. The pope has to battle Niccolo Machiavelli, a political radical. You know, all of these things were going on at the same time, and Michelangelo was right in the thick of it.
In a very small city. I mean, we're talking about a city of about 45,000 people. Everybody knew everybody else, especially the people who were—
Especially the capable networked people.
The higher up.
High energy.
That's right.
You know,
exactly.
Gene Openshaw has put together this wonderful spread in, I got to say, in our book, Europe 101, that's called The Class of 1500. And here, it's a little bit of a stretch, but you've got in the same class, in the same generation anyways, you got Christopher Columbus, Niki Machiavelli, Al Durer, Lorenzo the Magnificent, Pope Leo X, Savonarola, Amerigo Vespucci, Erasmus, Michelangelo, Henry VIII, Leonardo da Vinci, and Martin Luther, all living in the same generation, and many of those people in the same city.
Pretty impressive high school class.
Wow. And like Gene said, it was a small world. These people communicated. They wrote letters. They employed each other. And as travelers, we can appreciate that. Gene, if you're in Florence and you want to get a sense of this heady time, where do you go?
If you want to get the background of it, you just take a basic walk through Florence. The Uffizi Courtyard, you've got statues of all of these famous people. But Michelangelo could have stood, say, right in the center of town, right in front of the Duomo, and he would have seen it practically as a museum showcasing the work of the two previous generations that practically invented the Renaissance. You'd look up, there's the dome, made by Filippo Brunelleschi, patterned on an ancient building that was an engineering feat that matched that of the ancients. He'd look on the facade of the church, there's statues by Donatello, these realistic, heroic, brooding statues that recall the classical world and that inspired Michelangelo. He'd spin 180 degrees on his heel, he'd look at the baptistry with its bronze doors, with these realistic scenes made by Lorenzo Ghiberti, where he practically invents the concept of creating the illusion of a three-dimensional scene on what's virtually a two-dimensional surface. Right there, you're immersed in Michelangelo's world and the world that he grew up in.
You're on the cusp of something very exciting. You had these pioneers that Michelangelo, like you said, walked down the street and he'll see them. Donatello, his David, I understand, was the first freestanding male nude to be sculpted in 1,000 years.
That's right.
He would have been locked up for indecent sculpture a generation before that. Donatello made that leap, and Michelangelo must have been inspired by it. You got the cathedral. It was built in Gothic times, right? And they left the hole for the spire open because they didn't have the technology to build a dome yet. Knowing that spires were old school, we're going to get Renaissance here, we're going to go classical style. And Brunelleschi, the Florentine, came along with the technical know-how to put that dome on top.
How typical of the Italians to actually begin a church before they knew how they were going to finish it. They were very confident that God would send Brunelleschi to save things. He would find Florence a perfectly recognizable place now to the time, because this is one of the reasons why I think we're so attracted to the city, is because it so easily evokes the time that Michelangelo, Leonardo, and Raphael were living there.
And to take that notion that Gene was explaining, which is just, to me, I've never even thought of it, Gene, walking down the streets pretending you're in Michelangelo's mindset, how new and fresh and radical these innovations were, you can step into the Or San Michele Church and you're going right back into the Middle Ages. You've
Absolutely.
Got candlelit, gold leaf, pointy, lacy altarpiece, you know, with this very, very medieval sort of iconic altar, and go, wow, this is medieval Christian art. And then you can step across the street or take a look at the niches in that church and you see the modern age.
Yeah.
And everywhere you go in Florence, really, we've talked about Michelangelo growing up in the cradle of the Renaissance, which certainly is true, but he also grew up in a very Christian world. And those things side by side, you can see them in Florence all over, but they very much were the two poles that dominated Michelangelo's life, the Christian and the pagan Renaissance, medieval humility and piety, and Renaissance confidence in humanism.
Do I understand that when you think about humanism and medieval piety and so on, in the Middle Ages, the most noble art form was architecture because it was the house of God, and it was okay to put energy into that. And the other stuff, tapestries, windows, paintings, sculpture, embellished the house of God, so it was okay to do that too. Then in a humanist age, you can just make a fancy statue for a fancy family and put it in their fancy courtyard.
But we should always remember these aren't contradictory poles. Those poles that Gene mentions are absolutely complementary. You are both being observant of God by being a humanist, and you're being a human by being godly.
So Renaissance humanism is powered by Christian
Absolutely.
Faith. It's not a repudiation of God, but
Exactly.
it's just saying there's a modern kind of faith, and that's not to take it this superstitial bow down in church hall. You know, translating the Bible into the people's language. Martin Luther, same generation, same sort of confidence, right? We don't need the Word of God in Latin to be interpreted for us. We're humanists. We can get it in our language, we can read it, and we can then, as some leaders would say, chart our own path to hell.
Of course, that was a little bit shocking for everybody living in Italy to see the Bible translated up in the north.
So that was radical for that,
that
time.
That was very radical.
But is it tied into this humanism where you can look at it as not an anti-religious thing, but a new kind of religious
thing? I think certainly Martin Luther was thinking that way, but it was a threat to the Catholic Church.
Of course. And the Catholic Church had all of these guys by the... They had him controlled.
Yeah.
And who excommunicated Martin Luther? It was Pope Leo X, the young man that Michelangelo grew up with in the Medici household.
Okay, so when we're thinking about humanism, If I go to the Academia where you find Michelangelo's David standing like an altar, this is really a celebration of humanism.
And no matter how many times you've seen it in books, to step into that Academia Museum and see the David, people just inevitably go, oh my God, it is big, it is beautiful.
Amen.
Amen. And it's under a dome that was like purpose built.
That building was built for that.
Was it purpose
built?
For
the statue.
Because it works
display.
Perfect.
It does. It's a really beautiful space. The other thing we can say about it, it's really, if you think about Florence as a medieval city, the David is a large-scale Roman marble nude placed in the middle and the center of a medieval city, completely transforming its character into a modern world.
Huh. That's an emblem for that.
It is.
That's
indeed.
A powerful statement.
Very
when you think
powerful
about
statement.
At the front door of the where the city government was.
Precisely.
And we got to remember, these were city-states back then.
And very proud of their city-state independence.
Which is one thing that motivated these Florentines to really do well.
And the Florentines always identified with David because David, of course, is the young shepherd boy who's subjected to the much greater power of Goliath. And Florence always saw itself as a kind of small city-state against the much larger powers of Venice, Milan, and Genoa.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm speaking with Professor William Wallace. Professor Wallace's new book is Michelangelo, the Artist, the Man, and His Times. Professor Wallace teaches art history at Washington University in St. Louis. And I'm joined also by Gene Openshaw, co-author of Europe 101, History and Art for the Travelers. Our phone number is 877-333-RICK. You can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. Sherry's on the line in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Sherry, thanks for your call.
Well, thank you for having me. I was enjoying your discussion about David, and he had certainly an awesome statue. And the prisoners that are in the same building escaping from the stone are a favorite of mine. But there's a couple of things that are maybe a little lesser visited. One is the statue, which I believe is a self-portrait of Michelangelo called The Deposition. And it's the removal of Jesus from the cross with Nicodemus, as Michelangelo is Nicodemus, and that's really a very powerful statue. And the other thing that I remember was the stairway at the Laurentian Library, which was so graceful and reminded me of a cascade of water coming down into pools at the bottom. So both the sculpture of statues and also the architectural features of Michelangelo around Florence are just amazing.
I think those are both very good recommendations for the next time you go to Florence, because that great statue of Nicodemus and Michelangelo, he carved that actually as his own grave marker. So indeed, this was an extremely important and powerful portrait of himself and a sort of guarantee of his salvation on earth by carving this beautiful sculpture. And so I totally agree with you. And that stairway of the Laurentian Library, we tend to forget that Michelangelo is also an extremely important architect, and that he probably had a greater effect on the history of architecture than he even did on the history of sculpture. So you're absolutely right in making those two very good recommendations.
If I could just make it clear for listeners, when people want to see this wonderful Michelangelo deposition or Pietà, it is in the Museo del Duomo, the Museum of the Cathedral, immediately behind the cathedral. I was thinking how some of the Michelangelo art, you know, requires a reservation to see and long, long lines. There's never a line for that. And it is a very powerful piece of art that a lot of people don't even check out when they're in Florence.
One of the better museums precisely for that reason.
I agree. And then when we think about the word deposition and Pietà, is that the same thing or?
They're close. The Pietà is the moment when Mary meditates upon the body of her son. And this is technically a deposition. There are other figures, including the Mary Magdalene and the Nicodemus as well.
Gene, it's interesting, this whole notion of the underappreciated value of Michelangelo's architecture. As a sightseer, how do you appreciate that?
I'll touch on some of the things that Sherry talked about when she talks about that Laurentian Library and his work as an architect. Well, that is part of the Church of San Lorenzo. This large concept where Michelangelo was hired as an architect to decorate the facade of that church. If you go there today and you look for this facade and what you stare at is just bare brick. It's just to this day. In fact, all of the things that Sherry mentioned are part of this about 20-year period of Michelangelo's life where he worked on project after project after project and really completed very little. The Lernstein Library, he did complete the staircase, but nothing else left unfinished.
So the staircase was one element of what should have been a glorious facade by Michelangelo.
A redone entire library.
And today you see the rustic brick facade kind of roughed up so that the veneer can be put onto it.
Exactly. And he was hired to do the veneer. But that veneer of the Church of San Lorenzo left unfinished.
And why was that?
That's a long story.
It's a long story. Yeah. They ran out of money, let's say. Yeah.
But was the ego of some other patron that came in and got him sidetracked on another project?
Well, let's think about all those marbles that intended for the facade we end up seeing, actually, in the Medici Chapel today. A lot of that marble is reused. Absolutely.
That would have been
material
an incredible
is very, very
facade.
Valuable.
All right.
So,
Sherry, that was a great comment. Thank you very much, Sherry.
Thank you. It makes me want to go back to Florence.
Me too. Us too.
Gene, we've been trying to take us back 500 years to the age of Michelangelo, not counting being in a museum. Where would you go in Florence? Where would you take a visitor in Florence to feel the Florence of Michelangelo most vividly?
I would take them to the Church of Santa Maria Novella, which is right near the train station, just about a two-minute walk from the train station. And I would take them to the main altar and the chapel that's behind there. This is not done by Michelangelo. There's a series of frescoes done by Ghirlandaio. But this is where Michelangelo worked as a 13-year-old boy in his first artistic gig. He was hired by Ghirlandaio to mix plaster for this fresco work. And in there, you can look at the frescoes. You can see the pictures of Florence today, because the paintings show the men and women, men in their striped Romeo-type leotards and their Juliet-type dresses with their jewels on them. It shows the actually famous people of the time. You can picture young Michelangelo working in there, getting his first glimpse of what it would really be like to be a working artist. Michelangelo, who was born in Florence, could then take that cultural phenomenon of the Renaissance, spread it to Rome, throughout Italy, and then eventually spread all over Europe.
Professor Wallace, everybody looks at David and is impacted, inspired. When you look into the eyes of David, what do you see?
Well, Rick, I think that's why we need to go to Florence again and look at it in person, because we can't actually look into the eyes of David. We're always looking up to David. And I think why it continues to move us is because it's so awesome in its scale and its accomplishment that we don't actually have access to the eyes of David. It's always a world larger than ourselves, and in some ways inspires us to feel like we're part of a world larger than ourselves. And so this is why I think even 500 years later, we can still be moved by seeing this figure, even though it's as familiar as it is from books.
And we can be appreciative of that great generation, the generation of Michelangelo that helped bring us out of the Middle Ages and into the modern world.
Who did more than anybody else to help raise the stature of artists and make art into something that's really modern and significant still 500 years later.
Professor William Wallace, Gene Openshaw, Michelangelo Buonarroti, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Grazie.
Prego.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton and Sarah McCormick at Europe Through the Back Door in Edmonds, Washington. Special thanks to the folks at the Dublin Literary Pub Crawl and to Aaron Harding for helping with today's show. There's more online in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Join us again next week for more Travel with Rick Steves.